Welcome to another deep dive. We've gotten a ton of questions about DST, and you've sent over some fascinating research articles on it, so I figured it was time we dove in and explored decreased sound tolerance in children.
Sounds good to me.
Imagine being a kid and just everyday sounds, like a school bell ringing or a vacuum cleaner, just feel unbearably loud, almost painful.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality for many children dealing with DST.
Exactly. And it's more common than you might think.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the first things to understand is that DST can actually be divided into two main categories. We've got hyperacusis and misophonia.
Okay, so what's the difference? I'll admit, I always get those two mixed up.
I think a lot of people do. So with hyperacusis, everyday sounds are just perceived as extremely loud or even physically painful.
Right. So it's not just that they're annoying. It's like they actually hurt.
Yeah, exactly. Like imagine a child who can't even focus in class because the sound of pencils scratching on paper is just overwhelming for them.
Wow. Yeah, that's a whole other level.
It is. And then there's misophonia. And this one is where specific sounds, and they're often soft sounds like chewing or tapping, they trigger really intense negative reactions like anger or anxiety or even disgust.
Oh, yeah. I think we all know someone who gets a little bothered by chewing noises, but this is obviously way more extreme.
Oh, it is. And, think about a child who refuses to eat dinner with their family because the sound of everyone chewing is just so upsetting to them. It can be really isolating.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's really eye-opening reading through this research and seeing just how much these conditions can impact a child's life. I mean, we're not just talking about like minor annoyances here. This is affecting their ability to learn, to socialize, and to, enjoy everyday activities.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. These are real, neurological and psychological factors at play.
So it's not just about being, quote unquote, sensitive to sound.
Exactly. And that's something that I think is really important for people to understand.
Now, in the research you sent me, one of the things I was curious about was just how common these conditions actually are. Do we have any idea what the prevalence is?
Well, getting a precise number is really tricky because the prevalence estimates vary depending on, how we define and diagnose these conditions.
Yeah.
And there's not a ton of research on it, especially in children.
Right. It seems like that's a theme in this area, that there's a need for more research and more awareness.
Absolutely.
Now, you sent some interesting research on risk factors, too. Did anything in particular stand out to you in terms of, what might make a child more susceptible to these conditions?
Yeah, one thing that really caught my eye was the connection between hyperacusis and ASD, autism spectrum disorder.
Oh, interesting. So children with ASD might be more likely to experience this.
Yeah. That's what the research seems to suggest, and it's thought that maybe it's linked to differences in how their brains process sensory information.
Okay, yeah. So that makes sense that there could be a neurological connection there.
Yeah, and I think, for parents of children with ASD, this is definitely something to be aware of and to, be on the lookout for.
Absolutely. Were there any other potential risk factors that you came across?
Yeah, for hyperacusis specifically, some of the studies showed a link to things like being male, or having certain health issues as a newborn, or even just, a history of ear infections.
So it seems like there could be, a lot of different factors that contribute. And it's kind of like a puzzle where all these pieces come together.
Yeah, exactly. It's really complex.
Now, this actually brings me to another question that I had, assuming that a child is showing some of these signs, how are these conditions typically diagnosed?
Well, unfortunately, diagnosing hyperacusis and misophonia in children can be a real challenge.
Why is that?
Well, there's actually a real lack of questionnaires that are specifically designed for kids,
Oh, so the tools that we use for adults don't necessarily translate well.
Not always. So sometimes clinicians have to, use those tools, but very carefully, and they have to take into account, the child's developmental stage and all of that.
So what are researchers doing to kind of address this gap in assessment tools?
Well, there's some really exciting developments happening in that area. So for instance, there's a scale called the Sussex Misophonia Scale for adolescents that was created specifically to measure misophonia in younger age groups.
Oh, that's great. So that's a step in the right direction.
Exactly. And researchers are even starting to look at physiological measurements.
Oh, wow. So kind of like a hearing test, but more specialized.
Yeah, exactly. And the idea is to try and assess, hyperacusis more objectively, especially in children with ASD.
That's fascinating. So it sounds like there's a lot of work being done to try and improve these diagnostic tools and make them more child friendly.
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of progress happening in that area.
And this actually brings up another really interesting point from the research, which is the connection between DST and other conditions.
Yeah, there are definitely some interesting links there.
So what are some of the connections that stand out?
Well, one notable one is between hyperacusis and tinnitus. You know, that ringing or buzzing in the ears.
Oh, right. So people with hyperacusis might also experience tinnitus.
Exactly. They often occur together. And there's also a link between hyperacusis and ADHD.
Oh, that's interesting. Why would that be?
Well, one theory is that it might be because kids with ADHD can have a harder time filtering out sensory information.
So their brains are kind of getting overloaded with all the sensory input.
Exactly. And that might make them more susceptible to developing hyperacusis.
Okay, so it's not just about the sound itself, it's about how the brain is processing it.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to consider these other conditions when we're looking at DST.
Now, what about misophonia? Are there any connections there?
There's one that's particularly fascinating, and that's the link between misophonia and autism.
Okay, so obviously they're distinct conditions, but there's some overlap.
Yeah, exactly. Research suggests that kids with misophonia often show heightened sensory sensitivity in a variety of areas, you know, much like individuals with autism.
So it's not just sounds, it could be, touch or light, all sorts of things.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of a more holistic sensory experience.
That makes sense. And I think this actually leads us perfectly into our next topic, which is all about how these conditions are managed and treated.
Yeah, let's dive into that because there's a lot to unpack there.
Okay, so for parents who are listening and they're, concerned that their child might be dealing with hyperacusis or misophonia, what are some of the things that they can do?
Well, the most important thing to remember is that treatment really needs to be individualized,
Yeah.
you know?
Okay, so there's no magic bullet or one size fits all solution.
Exactly. Every child is different,
Yeah.
and their treatment plan should reflect that, you know?
Okay, so what are some of the options that are available?
Well, for hyperacusis, there are a few different approaches that can be helpful. Some kids might benefit from counseling to help them understand and manage their reactions to sounds.
So kind of like a therapeutic approach to help them cope with the emotional side of things.
Yeah, exactly. And then others might find relief through environmental sound therapy.
Oh, interesting. What is that?
So it involves gradually exposing them to certain sounds in a controlled way to kind of help desensitize them.
Oh, so it's like slowly getting them used to the sounds that bother them.
Exactly. And there are also things like relaxation techniques to manage stress and even behavioral therapy using tools like a sound ball.
Okay, I've never heard of a sound ball. What's that?
It's a really cool tool that can help with auditory desensitization, and it's a lot of fun for kids.
That sounds promising. So it seems like it's really a combination of addressing both the physical and emotional aspects of the condition.
Absolutely, you have to take a holistic approach.
Now, what about misophonia? Are there similar approaches for that?
Similar, but with some key differences. Therapies like cognitive behavioral therapy or CBT and dialectical behavioral therapy or DBT have shown a lot of promise in helping children manage their responses to trigger sounds.
Okay, so for those who might not be familiar with those terms, can you just give us a quick rundown of what CBT and WT are?
Sure. So CBT helps people identify and change negative thoughts and behaviors. So for a child with misophonia, it might help them reframe their thoughts about trigger sounds and learn coping strategies to manage their reactions.
Okay, that makes sense. And what about DBT?
DBT focuses on building skills like mindfulness and emotion regulation. So it can be really helpful for kids who are struggling with those intense emotional responses to trigger sounds.
Right, so it's about giving them the tools to kind of ride those waves of emotion and not get overwhelmed by them.
Exactly. And then there's also tinnitus retraining therapy, or TRT, which is originally designed for tinnitus, but it's also shown some benefits for misophonia.
Okay, so it's kind of borrowing from other areas of treatment and adapting them to fit this condition.
Exactly. And it's really encouraging to see how these therapies are being used to help kids with misophonia.
Absolutely. Are there any other interesting treatment approaches that are kind of on the cutting edge?
There's one that's particularly intriguing, and that's the use of MDMA.
Wow, okay, that's not what I was expecting. Why MDMA?
Well, MDMA has shown some promise in treating PTSD because it can help people process traumatic memories in a safe and supportive setting. And researchers are exploring whether it might also be helpful for misophonia by reducing those negative reactions to trigger sounds.
So it's kind of like rewiring those neural pathways that are associated with those intense negative responses.
Exactly. And it's a really fascinating area of research. But it's important to emphasize that this is still very early research. And like any research involving MDMA, there are, you know, ethical considerations and regulatory hurdles.
Of course, but the early findings are definitely interesting.
They are, and it's something to keep an eye on for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I'm really eager to learn more about some of these cutting-edge treatments, but before we dive into those, I want to take a closer look at some of the specific research studies that you found particularly interesting, because I think they'll really help to illustrate some of these concepts that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Let's do it.
Okay, so let's start with the study that I found really fascinating about the connection between misophonia and autism. What were some of the key findings from that research?
Well, you mentioned earlier that, you know, misophonia and autism are distinct, but there are these really interesting overlaps, and several studies have suggested that children with misophonia might have, you know, heightened sensitivity, not just to sounds, but in a variety of areas, much like those with autism.
Right. So their sensory experience is kind of heightened across the board.
Precisely. And one study, for example, found that children with misophonia, they scored higher on measures of sensory overresponsivity, and not just for sound. They were also more sensitive to things like touch or visual stimuli, and they also had more difficulty regulating their emotions, and they showed more autistic traits as well.
Wow, so it really does seem like there could be a shared underlying mechanism there related to sensory processing and emotional regulation.
Yeah, it's a pretty big insight and definitely an area that needs more research.
Absolutely. Were there any other sort of major findings from that study that stood out to you?
Well, another important finding was that misophonia can actually make panic disorders like Tourette's syndrome worse.
Oh, really? How so?
So you can imagine a child with Tourette's who also has misophonia, when they're exposed to a sound they really hate, their pterydex, can become more frequent and more severe.
Oh, wow. So it's like the misophonia is kind of adding fuel to the fire.
Exactly. And that's something that doctors definitely need to be aware of when they're treating children with pointing disorders.
Yeah, that's really important information. Now, speaking of treatment, you mentioned earlier that really cutting edge research on the use of MDMA for misophonia. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So the idea is that in a controlled therapeutic environment, MDMA could potentially help individuals reprocess their emotional and physiological responses to those trigger sounds.
So it's not about just blocking the sounds out. It's about actually changing how the brain reacts to them.
Yeah, exactly. And it's still very preliminary research, and there are definitely, you know, ethical considerations and regulatory challenges, but it's a really fascinating area of study.
I agree. Now, are there any other promising treatments that are sort of on the horizon?
Well, there's one study that's looking at a combined approach using cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and something called psychomotor therapy, PMT, to treat misophonia in children and adolescents.
Okay, so can you remind us again what CBT focuses on?
So CBT helps individuals identify and change negative thought patterns and behaviors. So for a child with misophonia, it might help them to, you know, reframe their thoughts about trigger sounds and learn coping strategies to manage their reactions.
Okay, and what about PMT? I'm not familiar with that one.
So PMT uses physical activity and body awareness mm-hmm. to kind of address emotional and psychological issues.
Oh, interesting. So it's kind of a mind-body approach.
Yeah, exactly. And the researchers believe that this combined approach could be particularly effective for this age group because it addresses both the mental and physical sides of misophonia.
Yeah, I can see how that would be especially helpful for kids and teens who are, you know, often so in tune with their physical sensations.
Absolutely.
Now, we've talked about specific therapies, but one of the articles you sent me mentioned something called the Unified Protocol. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so the Unified Protocol for Transdiagnostic Treatment of Emotional Disorders, or UPCA, it's a treatment approach that's designed to address a wide range of emotional disorders in children and adolescents. It's not specifically for misophonia.
Okay, so it's more of a general approach.
Right, but researchers wanted to see if it could be adapted to help young people with misophonia, you know, to better manage their distress and their overall functioning.
Interesting. And were they able to adapt it?
They combined it with traditional CBT techniques, and the initial findings are actually quite promising. Participants in the study showed improvements in their ability to cope with trigger sounds, and they also reported feeling less anxious and depressed overall.
Wow, that's fantastic. So it's great to see researchers, you know, thinking outside the box and trying different approaches.
Absolutely. And I think it really highlights the fact that we're just scratching the surface when it comes to understanding and treating misophonia in kids.
I agree. There's still so much to learn. And one area that I think really needs more attention is the impact of misophonia on a child's daily life. You know, we've touched on it briefly, but I'd love to hear you elaborate a little bit on how this can affect a child's experiences at school, at home, and in social situations.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's start with school. Imagine a child with misophonia trying to concentrate in a classroom full of rustling papers and clicking pens and whispering classmates.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that sounds like a nightmare.
It can be, and you know, they might have trouble focusing, they might get easily distracted, and they might even have, you know, meltdowns because of the overwhelming sensory input.
Right, it sounds incredibly stressful, not just for the child, but for the teachers and the other classmates too.
It can be tough for everyone involved, and it's not just school that's challenging. You know, family dinners can become battlegrounds, movie theaters can feel like torture chambers, even